I'm very happy now to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Dean Falk. She's an evolutionary anthropologist. She's a senior scholar at the School for Advanced Research, and she will be speaking tonight at 6:30 at the New Mexico History Museum Auditorium, giving a talk called Whence Language, the Role of Mothers and Infants. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, thank you.
So this is a very interesting look at the formation of language in human beings, and you go way back to our primate ancestors and relatives to start thinking about this. Why go back so far? That's not what linguists usually do.
Right. Well, I'm an evolutionary anthropologist, and so and I'm interested in brain evolution and the evolution of cognition. And to begin to study that, we need to look at our closest relatives within the non-human primates, that is great apes. And we know that people and our nearest cousins, the chimpanzees, are descended from a common ancestor that lived perhaps 5 to 7 million years ago. So in asking these kinds of questions about human evolution, that's how far back we go.
One of the things that you talk about, which was so interesting to me, was the concept of grasping. Grasping is a physical and a linguistic. You grasp a new idea. You grasp your mother.
Yes. Grasping is very, very important in terms of evolution, and it's something that isn't usually thought about. We have infants who are born very, very helpless, as any parent will tell you. And unlike all of the other higher primates, unlike the hundreds of species of monkeys and the handful of ape species, our infants never get to the point where they can glom on to their mother's bellies and backs without support. And so we've lost, it was an evolutionary reversal, we lost that ability, our babies did, to hang on to their mothers. And that really, I think, profoundly altered the course of human evolution and impacted brain evolution.
So there's a lot of ways in which we are different from our primate ancestors, and some of them seem to be almost a step backwards, like the one you just mentioned. It's also, we have way more pain in childbirth. We have a lot of things like the fact that our infants stay immature longer makes us more vulnerable in the wild. All of these things are things that you write about in the book. What's the connection to language?
Okay, these are trade-offs. It's the price we pay for having evolved large brains and the cognitive advances that separate humans apart from the other primates. And in terms of grasping and language origins, at the point where infants could no longer hang on 24/7 to their moms had to periodically put them down. So there was a physical separation. And the infants didn't like this at all. In fact, on those rare occasions that the other primates, that their infants fall off of their mothers, they don't like it. And so it opened up a new two-way channel between infants and their mothers, which was a vocal channel. And it had to do with the infants really not being happy with the separation and trying to seek, closeness with the parent, complaining, and then with the mothers responding in like, that is vocally. So we have an evolution of crying. Humans cry completely different than the other primates, in which infants try and control and do control their parents. And then of early ancestral mothers responding to the distress of their infants with soothing kinds of vocalizations. So it opened up a two-way back and forth channel, which would have gone on for millions of years. And this ultimately, I think, paved the way for more complicated kinds of vocal interactions, namely language.
Now, we're going to talk about that and specifically baby talk or motherese, as it's called, as you mm-hmm. call it, in a moment. But just this idea of putting the children down, how do you know that early humans put their infants down as opposed to, I was thinking of like big Italian families. They never put their infants down. They give them to somebody else
right.
in the family.
Right. And that did eventually happen where you would have others, siblings perhaps, or other adults help carry offspring. But when we model the earliest ancestors, we look at the apes, and we look at the organization and the way they made their living, which was through foraging, in which individuals, you know, get up in the morning, climb out of the trees, and separate and go their own ways. And you may have a small group of adult females with their offspring, but fairly soon in life, they'll have offspring of their own. And so the mother really is a primary carrier of particularly nursing infants. And so it would have been, you know, eventually there would have been sharing of, you know, of that responsibility. But if you look at chimpanzee mothers, they're very reluctant to let even a sibling or even their own mothers hold their infants until they are somewhat mature. They're very protective.
So let's talk about baby talk, motherese. Is mm-hmm. that, did you coin that term?
Or? I did not. Okay. No, it's been around for a long time.
We probably, everybody listening to this broadcast knows what you mean by that. It's mm-hmm. the kind of language that contains English or whatever the uh-huh. mother's language is, but also a kind of exaggerated, how would you describe mm-hmm. it?
It's musical. It's also called musical speech or infant-directed speech, and it is universal. Women, in fact, parents around the world do it. And if you've done baby talk, and who hasn't, well, then you're familiar with it. But it's a special kind of speech which is very exaggerated, melodic. There are high pitches. It's often slow, exaggerates certain words. And it expresses emotions, you know, love towards the infant. It changes as infants get older. Eventually it becomes sort of directional, where parents will instruct infants, no, you know, don't go near that light socket. And then eventually it's very important for the infant to learn the nitty-gritty of its own language. You know, people have to learn how to parse the speech stream. You know, you're born hearing a bunch of noises that are strung together. Now, if I listen to Chinese, I can't parse it. And our infants are born without language. And by the time they're getting to be around a year old, they're getting language. And a lot of that is acquired because of the special kind of speech they're getting from others, because of motherese.
So the mother teaches the children not only language, but really music. I mean, you make the case that music and language are really inextricable from each other and both natural to human beings.
Yes. They're complementary. They both have to do with complex sounds and organizing them and perceiving them and producing them. And they, I believe, evolve together. They entail different parts of the brain, but they timeshare parts of the brain.
So how does this way that you're talking about of looking at the acquisition of language differ from previous theories of infants acquiring language?
My theory of language origins focuses on mothers and infants. And this is different from other workers who have looked at things like Charles Darwin looked at gibbon song and said language came out of the emotional vocalizations of our primate-like ancestors. Others have focused on males, on hunting males, as having been the focus of natural selection that resulted in language. Others think that it had to do with tool production, that it was a way of communicating, you know, how to make a tool, that vocalizations came in there. So there have been lots of different theories about how language originated and in whom. It's been extremely controversial for a long, long time.
We're talking to Dean Falk about her book, Finding Our Tongues. As I was reading your book, and you talk about this a little bit, but it seems like it really takes a female anthropologist to think about it in that way, because the experience of motherhood is something that you have had and felt and observed in a way that even the most loving daddy probably hasn't quite done.
Yeah, I think that that perhaps it was more likely that women would consider the role of women and babies in language origins than men. And I began thinking about it years ago, maybe a decade ago, because I was at a conference where a woman was speaking. Ellen Dissanayake is her name. And she talked about the role of mothers and infants in terms of temporal arts and music and dance. And she spoke of motherese, and for me it was an epiphany. It was an aha experience. And that really got me thinking about motherese, because no other animal does this the way humans do. Other animals, of course, have contact calls. If infants should become separated from their mothers, they will make little peeps or clicks or whatever, depending on the species, and the mother may answer in kind. But there's no other animal that has this constant barrage of a special way of vocalizing of the mother towards the infants. It's only in people. And it was a mystery after hearing Dissanayake talk. It was a mystery. Like, where did this motherese come from in people? Well, it had to have evolved because it's unique. And that sort of started me thinking along these lines. And it took a while to, because I kept wondering, well, why? And then I realized, well, our babies can't hang on. Those non-human primates that hang on, they're happy as clams. They want to be attached 24/7 to their mothers, and they are. So there's not a two-way vocalization going on. But at the point where that ceased to exist, the vocal channel had to have opened up. And so I think that's where motherese came in. It soothes, it comforts, it hushes. It would have been very adaptive, because if you're out there in the savannah or wherever with the lions and whatnot, you don't want your baby that you've put down to announce its presence to the world. So one can see that it would have been very adaptive from the beginning.
So let's play out the scenario. You're a mother in the savannah. You have an infant. You're out looking for food. You put the baby down.
Right. And you don't put it down very far away from where you are if you want a baby at the end of the day.
Right.
You put it down within eyesight and maybe even closer than that. And we do this. We put our babies down. If you want to fold the laundry, you can't do it if you've got the baby in your arms. But you put it down in a bassinet or a playpen, and it's right there. And so this is kind of an obvious thing to do. And when women and when mothers were making their livings by traveling and foraging, eating on the go, they would have had to use their hands to dig up those tubers or pick those fruits or just pick flowers.
And so the little nearby infant was prevented from screaming and crying by this soothing language of the mother.
It was coaxed to be quiet. Meanwhile, the crying itself evolved. Our babies cry very differently than other primates. We shed real tears. And the crying is instrumental, actually, in the acquisition of speech.
Say more about that. How does that work?
This is work done by some German researchers over a couple of decades. And what they did was they started studying crying in infants, thinking of them as biosirens that indicated health issues, that kind of thing. And what they realized was that the cries were changing over the time. A 6-week-old infant cries differently than even a 2-month-old infant, and so on up to about 4 months of age. And there's a pattern to it across babies. And what they realized was that the cries of the infants were actually warming up the vocal apparatus to babble. And the babbles are a warm-up for being able to, have those first words, etc. And so they put that together, and what's very interesting is their recent work has shown that babies in different cultures, you know, cry differently. You can cry in French or cry in German.
That's what I was wondering.
Yeah, same thing with babbling.
Yeah.
And it's all part of, you know, getting to the point of having language. You're born without it, and you've got to go through all these stages. And the crying is an important part of that, and the development of crying.
So if language is heavily associated with being held and talked to by your mother, then language inherently, I would think, has affection in it, has love in it, has affective connection between people. I mean, it's relational.
Yes. Yes. Certainly during evolution, with the motherese, the vocalizations would not have been words. At first, they would not have had semantic meanings. They would have been emotional, they would have been soothing, calming, persuasive, and they would have been expressive of love. And language today, you know, we think of it as words and sentences, and we say things that have meanings. And of course, that's a hugely important part of language. But there's a whole nother aspect to it, which is equally important, but not as recognized, which has to do with the musical aspects or the tone of voice when we speak. And that is very, very informative to listeners, particularly adult listeners who've learned how to decode it in detail. And so it gives a lot more information than just what an individual is saying. It'll, for instance, tell listeners, should you believe what they're saying? And you'll get a glimpse into perhaps their emotional, the emotional undertones that are underneath what it is that's being transmitted in the words. And so you get these emotional aspects that come out in tone of voice from one part of the brain, and that's going simultaneously with the decoding of the, you know, the linguistic, the words themselves.
How does the phenomenon of motherese lead not only to words but to grammar?
I think that the development was sequential through evolution. Before you can have grammar, you've got to have those words. And before you can evolve words, you've got to evolve a habit of two-way vocalization. And we can see motherese easily leading to the two-way vocalizations to do with infants trying to, you know, expressing their discontent at being separated from mothers and trying to reestablish, you know, trying to get the comfort, the contact, comfort. When we, to approach your question, you can actually look at living people during their first year of life and see them get from, you know, the first cry after being born on up to the first words. And it entails, you know, getting to the point where there's a vocal give and take between the mother and the infant, and the maturation of the crying that we just talked about, getting to the point where the baby can babble, and eventually the baby's babbling syllable-like sounds, and stringing them together as the infant gets older, perhaps around 9 months of age. And then you have the mother interacting with the infant. And in a sense, it's the parent, the mother, that shapes those first words. We'll say, oh, the baby's first word, which is often, in many cultures, mama, or its equivalent. And what happens is you've got the little baby babbling, mama, ma, ba, 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 mama. And mom goes, oh, a word, that means me. And so, in a way, it's a two-way invention. So, during evolution, once you get to that point, then you need individuals who actually invent the words. So words had to have come first. And there's a lot of speculation about what they were. Mama is a big one. But the idea that there would have been nouns and then verbs, and eventually other kinds of words, and that you would have individuals who would start, you know, stringing them together and getting the idea that, as our infants do, that you can glue words together. And it would have been individuals inventing the conventions for how they're stringed together, and then others picking those conventions up. So it's a logical sequence. And I think if we look at psycholinguistics of living babies, we get really good clues about how it must have unfolded during the course of early evolution.
Did you spend a lot of time watching babies when you were developing this work?
No, I didn't like go seek babies. I'd been exposed to quite a few babies. I mean, I had two myself, and I have 6 grandchildren. So I had quite a bit of experience with babies, but I didn't go out there and do field work. I do remember when my agent for this book was considering my proposal. She told me she was sitting in a coffee shop, probably much like this, reading my proposal. And at the next table, there was a mother with a little baby. And she said it was as if they were illustrating what it was I was reading.
Amazing.
And in people, I mean, you can see this anywhere. You can go out and you can see. When you see mothers and infants, you'll immediately see mother ease in action if those are young infants. And also with fathers, too. I speak of mothers and infants in an evolutionary sense. Because back when I'm talking about paternity wasn't recognized and the guys probably weren't around that much. It was interaction between mothers and infants. But of course today, everybody participates in this, including dads.
We're talking to Dean Falk about her book, Finding Our Tongues, and her lecture tonight, Whence Language, the Role of Mothers and Infants. So let's talk about art. I mean, you had this epiphany about the role of mothers and babies and language when hearing somebody talk about temple dances and things like that. Yeah. So how does all this work with the seemingly human activity of art making?
Yeah. Well, if you think about language for a minute, what it consists of is we spew out little bits of air, you know, out of our vocal cords, and then we mold them and chop them up and spew them from our mouth into hopefully meaningful sequences. And the brain is able to work in these little sequences, and in producing speech, we move them around and glue them together in new ways. So it's sort of analytical and sequential and dealing very rapidly with a lot of little information. And in learning it, one learns from little pieces to bigger pieces. You have to learn a word and then several words before you can put 2 words together and then more words together in a phrase and then eventually make sentences, that kind of thing. And so it's this neurological machinery for doing this, I think, came from working with sounds and for the tone of voice and the music in the right hemisphere and the vocalizations and the semantic language in the left hemisphere. But if you look at something like art, and if you look at little kids and how they acquire art, they acquire it piecemeal, where they'll start out with apparently senseless just scrawls on a paper and eventually we'll get, so those scrawls are a little better form. They might do kind of an odd oval, for instance. And later we'll, there's a delightful stage where they draw what's called tadpole figures, which is you get your circle and it's got arms and legs sticking out of it. So in a way it's very linguistic, the way they learn art.
So that's amazing. So it starts in the same way. I mean, you've got babblings and then words and then phrases. That's so cool.
Yeah. So scribbles are like babbles. Scribbles are visual babbles. And youngsters go through similar stages in acquiring their artistic skills as they do when they acquire their language.
So when you are looking at some children, I mean, it's been studied, and you write about this in your book, some children are better at acquiring language, acquire it more quickly or more fluently. What are some of those differences? How do you explain them? How do you observe them?
Yeah, there have been studies, again, by psycholinguists that have looked at children and have done retrospective studies where they'll look at them at say, 2, age 2 or 2.5 and see how they're doing in terms of, you know, their vocabularies and their language skills. And they'll go back and look at earlier studies that were done to see if there were any connections. And the crying stuff that we talked about, for instance, they did that. And it's been shown that, contrary to what some parents think, that those children that are exposed to more and clearer motherese actually acquire their languages earlier and better than children that aren't. And so it's, you know, I think some parents think, oh, I'm not going to demean my child by speaking to them in baby talk.
Well, I mean, I know somebody, he was the son of factory workers, but his mom had been an English major and she wanted him to speak well. She never spoke a word of baby talk to him. She spoke absolutely full sentences. And this guy spoke like a poet.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he recovered.
You mean he would have been better off, you think, had
Who
his
knows?
Mother...
Who knows? But studies do show that it does help infants acquire their language. And when you think about what it does, for instance, when parents speak to their baby in baby talk, they are unconsciously teaching things about language. For instance, mothers will exaggerate the vowels in the baby talk, and that helps the infants learn something about their language. Now, the mothers, I don't think, are saying to themselves, oh, I'm going to exaggerate the vowels.
Right. Yeah, I mean, we evolved. Right? We didn't make this up.
Yeah.
But at the same time, what's interesting, one of the things you say is there's a lot of people who talk kind of baby talk to their dogs, but there's differences in what they do with their dogs than what they do with their children.
Yeah, and they think that, you know, well, I speak baby talk, I'm doing motherese to my dog or my cat, and that's actually been studied. And they are talking to their dog and their cat in a way that sounds like motherese, and the aspects, the acoustic aspects, are expressing love and affection. And the study actually compared them, mothers, how they talk to their babies, their cats and or dogs, and then others, and I like to think of the others as perhaps their husbands. And... very different to all three. And the thing that was different between the pets and the babies was that the mother was emphasizing unconsciously the linguistic, the language aspects to the infant and also the content. The mother often would ask the question and then answer it for the baby. Oh, is baby happy? Oh, yeah, I'm happy. But wouldn't do that with the dog or the cat. So there was content also. Differences.
So basically, unconsciously, we're expressing affection to our pets, and we're expressing affection and teaching language to our children.
Yes. Yes.
This is very, very interesting. The book is called Finding Our Tongues. Does any of this, I mean, when you think about this in terms of other creatures who do have their own kinds of languages, for example, we've talked about prairie dogs on this program, and they have nouns and verbs, and they have basic syntax that is demonstrated through their alarm call, so they can say, watch out for the coyote, stage right, kind of thing.
Right, right.
How does that relate to your studies of language, if it does?
Yeah. Well, that's called referential calling. And there are some non-human primates that do that too, most famously vervet monkeys. They'll have a call for eagles that will be different than a call for leopards, that sort of thing. It's referential, but it only occurs in very specific contexts, and it doesn't get transferred to any other situation. So it's very, very specific and narrow, so it's something that one would assume you would need to get that far to go further and get language. But with language, what we can do is take little bits of noise and rearrange them and say an infinite variety of things.
Dean Falk is an evolutionary anthropologist. She's a senior scholar at the School for Advanced Research, and she will be giving a talk tonight called Whence Language, The Role of Mothers and Infants. It's at the New Mexico History Museum Auditorium at 6:30, sponsored by the School for Advanced Research. For more information, you can go to sarweb.org. Dean, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.